to Inside Education, the weekly slot on 103.2 Dublin City FM that brings you the best from the world of education from an Irish perspective. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On this week's programme, I want to tie up some loose ends. Each week on the radio programme, I bring you half an hour of an interview with a guest who has insights to share about education. However, the interviews don't always finish in half an hour, and often interesting material remains after the programme has been edited for a particular week. This week, I'm bringing you pieces from previous guests that could not be fit into their original programmes. Later, we'll hear from Akihiko Takahashi and Katie Novak, but I begin with an additional clip from a more recent guest, Hilda Borko. Professor Hilda Borko is an educational psychologist at Stanford University. She is particularly interested in professional development for teachers in mathematics and science education. She's a former president of the American Educational Research Association. So I began this part of our interview by asking her how she goes about doing her work. This was her response.
I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. So how do I fit it all in? What are my preferred work styles?
Yes, all of that.
That's a complicated question. I like working collaboratively, so I like working with teams. In terms of writing, the work that we're doing is very complicated. We have huge amounts of data. We have different kinds of data. One of the challenges is figuring out where to start. Like, what's the first question that we want to ask? What's the first set of data that we want to look at? And making those decisions. In our particular instance, we've got a team. Some of people are in the PhD program, some are not. Some are more interested in learning to do data analysis and writing. So it's figuring out the right mix of who's doing what, and then how do the two faculty members provide guidance and structure. If it were just me, I like having blocks of time to write. I don't like having to write in bits and pieces. The kind of analyses we do with video is somewhat tedious, so I don't want to do that for more than an hour or two at a time.
And would you write every day, for example?
No. I mean, I can't remember the last time I had the luxury of writing every day except when I was on sabbatical. You know, and right now I'm chair of the curriculum and instruction program area within our School of Education, which means I spend a lot of time in meetings. And I try to have meetings in the afternoons, and I try to have meetings only on certain days so that I can have at least 3 mornings a week that in theory I can devote to research, whether that's data analysis or writing or planning. This last project, a lot of the work has been planning and preparing for the professional development. So we're trying hard to move the balance so we can spend more time on the conceptual issues in the research.
If you could make one change to your current school, and we can include reducing the number of meetings, but if resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
I would do more to encourage and support collaborative work. I think that there's a strong tendency for people to work on their own or work with graduate students and not work collaboratively. And I would encourage, if time were not an issue, more opportunity for people to learn about one another's work and to share their work.
Yeah, there is such a tendency to just work within your own little cocoon and to not relate to others.
And I think that's sort of endemic to higher education.
What from your own primary or post-primary educational experience informs your practice in education today?
Post-primary being like secondary
school? Yes.
I honestly don't think that much, because education schooling is so different now than it was. I mean, what affects it much more is the experience we had when we started school. And what does it really mean to try to learn yourself to teach in different ways, to try to learn to enact a pretty radically different philosophy? So the contrast between the classroom I was in as a student teacher and the kind of school we were creating was so different. And I think some of the work we're doing now in the U.S. as a whole, around reform and student-centeredness is very much compatible with the kind of work that we did when we were starting our school. It's not totally the same, so I draw a lot more on that experience. And then I draw on my son's experiences when he was in school. He was in a magnet school that was a parent involvement school, so I spent a lot of time in his school. And I spent a lot of time in classrooms, not the way Deborah Ball did, taking over an entire math curriculum, but I think for the first 5 years, the first 6 years anyhow, I was in his math class at least once a week.
And is that the definition of a magnet school?
There's different definitions. So typically what a magnet school is in the U.S. is it's a school that has a particular theme. It might be parent involvement, it might be a STEM school, it might be an arts school, so they have a particular theme or focus, and it's typically not a neighborhood school, so it will draw from the district, not just from the immediate neighborhood.
And that description of magnet schools in the United States came from Professor Hilda Borko from Stanford University. Earlier in the year, I interviewed Katie Novak when she addressed the conference of AHEAD, the Association for Higher Education, Access and Disability. The subject of her talk was Universal Design for Learning, ways to make learning accessible to all students, regardless of disabilities we may have. In this part of the interview, I asked her how the challenges of implementing universal design for learning at university level differ from the challenges of implementing them at other levels of the education system.
They are the same challenges. So I work as a graduate instructor. I do teach college courses all the time. And I think that I struggle with the same exact things that the first grade teachers and the middle school teachers and the high school teachers are struggling with, in that it's really tempting to want to be able to teach things my way. And, for example, I can show you the way that I design a lesson plan. And there's a temptation to want to say, this is how you design a lesson plan, and I want you all to do it. I teach graduate courses in education. And in those courses, I have teachers who are going to teach, middle school or elementary school, and I have teachers who are college professors, taking a course on how to, improve pedagogy. And it's so tempting to say, this is how you design a lesson plan. And so I want you to read my lesson plan, and then I want you to replicate one. Because it would be so much easier if I did it that way. And instead to say, this is one example. And the goal is that you create a lesson that works for you and that really allows you to meet the needs of your students. And you tell me the best way to do that. Do you want to do it in a PowerPoint? Do you want to just call me on the phone and tell me if you're not someone who writes it down? And I feel like I'm spread in 100 directions sometimes. But it's not about me as an instructor. It's about, is everyone who's going to leave my class going to be able to look at the learning outcomes and say, yes, absolutely, I get that. And I have to do whatever it takes. And again, if you think back to what we talked about at the beginning about being an expert teacher, that requires me to be creative and flexible and to overcome these barriers, because doing things in one way is certainly easier for the teacher.
And supposing someone says, well, no, I actually don't want to do a lesson plan. I don't believe in doing a lesson plan. I can just go in and I can talk off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that?
Then I would say, okay, so how about you could videotape yourself and you could send it to me if you don't mind asking one of your students to record your lecture. If you want to do that, if you want to send me the notes, maybe you have one student take notes, you want to send me the notes and then your reflection on those notes and how you think it went. If you want to interview a student afterwards, that would be great. But the goal is does your lesson have UDL principles? And there's a lot of ways that I could probably figure that out. And what I don't want it to feel like is compliance. I don't want anyone in a graduate class to feel like I'm doing this because it's an assignment. I want them to say, I'm designing lessons because it matters, that, my work matters for students, and I'm going to do this in a way that I'm going to do it, and then I can give them feedback, and my way is not the only way to do it. And so it's a lot of faith in each other, and that if we work together, if we're truly a village, we can get to the end together.
What does assessment look like in a classroom that applies universal design for learning principles?
It looks very different than assessment in a traditional classroom. And again, I would say that depends largely on what you're building towards. I know that there's still standardized assessments. There are in the United States as well. And what I always say to my educators is, if we teach students what they need to know and what they be able, you know, what they need to be able to do, and we teach them how to think and to solve problems, and we give them exposure to the type of questions and format they're going to see in a test, they're going to do just fine. So there's some assessments. So for example, if I need students to become familiar with multiple choice, for example, I might teach a lesson on how do you write and answer a really great multiple choice question. And there might be options on that. And then maybe at the end, that assessment is a multiple choice test, because that's actually what I'm measuring, is the ability to take a multiple choice test. But if I'm measuring your understanding of photosynthesis, it does not have to be a multiple choice test. It could be, again, a presentation about photosynthesis or a child's book, or they might choose to take the traditional test in the book, or it might be an essay kind of explaining what they learned. And so it really comes down to, what is the learning outcome? And sometimes the learning outcome is, I have this big standardized test coming up and they need to be able to take a multiple choice test. Then make that your learning outcome and create a universally designed lesson on that.
How did you become interested in the area of universal design for learning?
By accident. I was a seventh grade teacher. I had been teaching for a while. I had already had a doctorate at that point. And my district was awarded a grant to work directly with CAST. They're the fathers and mothers of UDL. And I was trained by them directly through this grant about 10 years ago. And I fell hook, line, and sinker. And as a part of the grant, they would come out frequently and they would do interviews on the people who were receiving professional development. And we had a radio interview like this that David Rose, who's now a friend of mine, heard, and he wanted to meet me, and the rest is history. So it was that I was a part of professional development that mattered to me, and I was in the right place at the right time to make a connection that would allow me to have a lifetime full of professional development.
We're coming near the end, Katie, so I have a few general questions. Who or what inspires you?
I love being a teacher, and I know that that sounds so, like, it sounds like a canned answer, but I am never happier than when I am teaching and learning, and I love walking into classrooms and seeing the possibility that education offers. I feel really lucky in my life. I'm born of two educators. Both my parents are educators. I've been a teacher since, you know, I graduated from college, and I can't imagine any other job in the world that anyone could do that would be more important. And so what inspires me is, the best job I ever had was teaching seventh grade, including now. I'm not a teacher anymore. I'm an administrator and I teach graduate courses. But I loved that so much. I loved the possibility in kids. I have four kids of my own. And, you know, right now what inspires me is the fact that we have the potential to make their lives amazing if we can transform teaching and learning.
Have you a favorite book or blog or writer about education?
I read voraciously. I read a book a week. I can't even pick one. The last book I read was Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, The Secret of Success. I am now newly obsessed with him. The week before that, I read The Gift of Failure by Jess Lahey. She's a tremendous education writer. I would say right now I probably read her the most. She writes for The Atlantic and The New York Times, and I don't know how she churns out so many blogs, but I really love her perspective. I read, you know, everything written by CAST, you know, so David Rose is a great one. And so, again, I read what inspires me, and it's always about teaching and learning and what it takes for people to be successful.
What from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
I've said this publicly many times, but I was not a stellar student. I was a very nice girl, and so I got through education just fine, because the comments in my report cards would always say something like, could apply more effort, but pleasure to have in class. And so, you know, my parents were always like, oh, she's a nice girl. And I ended up having Mrs. Krause my junior year of English, and she pulled me aside and said, what are you doing? You are just wasting it. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what am I wasting? And she's like, it kills me to see somebody with so much creativity and so much drive just wasting it. So I refuse to tolerate this anymore. You're going into like these honors classes, and I, you know, you're going to eat lunch with me until you figure it out, because you might not be there yet, but you're doing it. And I was really like, you can't force me to take these hard classes. And she's like, I've already talked to your father, it's happening. And when I went into her classroom and I had, you know, I was surrounded by all of these students who really took learning seriously and who were, you know, voracious readers and who loved it, you know, I felt suddenly at home, and it changed the trajectory of my whole life. I took another class with her senior year. I went and got my bachelor's degree. I went in to get my master's and my doctorate. And I don't think I would have done any of that if it wasn't for her. And so it was really, I had one teacher who believed in me enough to knew that I could do something different. And I want every kid to feel that.
And going back to the reading for a minute, where do you get all the time to do the amount of reading you do?
In bed, on my phone, I download ebooks, and every night before bed, I do not watch TV. That is my secret. Every night as I lay in bed, I read for about an hour, and I blow through books that way.
And finally, Katie, how can someone find out more about your work?
You can Google me at any time. My name is Katie Novak, and I have a website, Katie Novak UDL. And again, I've written, you know, three different books on UDL. Right now, I'm working on a fourth one. The first is called UDL Now, which is written primarily for teachers. I wrote UDL in the Cloud, which is how do you do this online? Because I also teach some online courses, and so much of education is hitting the cloud, you know, just because of accessibility, that, you know, how can you keep these principles of choice when students are logging onto their computers? And then UDL, University Design Leadership, is all about how do you do this on an administrative level. And the next book, which I'm really excited about, is called UDL Understood, and it's about how do we get parents to buy into this, which kind of leads back for this village, is we want people to believe in the power of choice and the fact that it may not look as rigorous, but it's more rigorous than it's ever been, because critical thinking and higher order thinking will require much more from students than, you know, memorization and knowledge ever did.
So Katie Novak's website and the books she's written provide a really good introduction to the principles of universal design for learning. Next, I bring you an excerpt from my interview with Professor Akihiko Takahashi. He is a respected mathematics educator from Japan who works in the United States, and he visited Ireland to talk about the teaching of mathematics. He was a guest of the UCD Japan group earlier this year when he spoke about teaching through problem solving. In this part of the interview, I began by asking Professor Takahashi if it is always the teacher's responsibility if a student does not learn.
Teaching is a profession. If students are not doing good, before you blame student, you have to think about what I can do better for the student. If you are not professional, you can blame your customer. But if you are professional, before you blame customer, you need to think about what I can do better.
How do Japanese textbooks support teachers in teaching problem solving?
Well, there is a big shift during 80s to 90s. Before this 80s, the Japanese textbook is more like a level 2 teaching. However, it's a big shift because of the problem solving has been emphasized, and then the Japanese curriculum material is shifted. Because this is the teachers start doing lesson study to examine this teaching through problem solving, the request from teachers, you know, encourage publisher to rethink about their curriculum. So the lesson study is not only teacher professional development. There's a kind of fine mechanism for publishers to re-examine their contents. So the Japanese curriculum, you know, after 90s, is really supporting teachers to be able to teaching through problem solving.
And what brought about this change in Japanese mathematics education to emphasize problem solving and teaching through problem solving in the early, in the 80s and 90s?
Well, the big emphasis is coming from the United States. And in the U.S., the standard movement is National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. They released a document called Agenda for Action, which is published in 1980s. And then that emphasized 80s should be a decade for problem solving. And before that, the 1945, the Porrier's How to Solve It was very popular in Japan. Because before 1945, that the Porrier's book came out, people do not believe anybody can be a problem solver. Only the people who have a talent can be a problem solver. But the Porrier's book changing the culture. If you teach well, anybody can be a problem solver. And then that influenced a lot. And then NCTM standard, and that influenced a lot. And then Japanese teachers very seriously take that notion. And then through this lesson study to come up all these ideas.
The irony is that the Americans weren't as successful themselves in implementing a problem-solving approach across schools as the Japanese were. Why is that, I wonder?
Well, again, going back to Shuhari, once you find out that the good ideas, they try to work very hard to make it happen. And then you modify a little bit after you understand the heart of these activities. US, unfortunately, they try to modify at the beginning, even before you really understand the heart of this idea.
Where did the decision in the United States come from to emphasize problem solving? Was that from Polya's book?
Yes. And then also Alan Schoenfeld, you know, his work on the problem solving during the 80s. And there are a lot of good studies. And then the NCTM standard is based on the problem solving, emphasizing. Okay. However, after that, it somehow do not implement effectively. So when I came to the United States first time, I thought that every single US classroom using idea of teaching through problem solving. However, I hardly see it. And I was shocked that happened.
And about how big are classes in elementary school in Japan? What class size?
The class size is 40 students, up to 40 students. And then younger graders recently, they reduced like 30, 35. However, most classroom is 40 students. So if you teach one by one, it's impossible. So the Japanese teachers working very hard to establishing a classroom culture so that the student can learn together.
And are there many special schools or would there be many children with special educational needs in those classrooms?
Well, basically, the most classroom is all inclusive. Of course, there is a very physically difficult for students to fit into the regular classroom. Those students, there are special classroom, but basically we try to include all the students. However, recent year, more and more students have some the challenges, so it's become very difficult for many teachers. However, the basic kind of stance is to include all these students in one classroom so that we do not want students to be separated or ability level grouping. We do not use it.
Who or what inspires you?
That's a very interesting question. I've been doing lesson study for 30 plus years, and I always inspired by my colleagues. We observe the same lesson. However, he or she could be able to see something I couldn't. So I'm always inspired by my colleagues. And then, I wanna be like that. So that helps me a lot. So even now, when I observe lesson, I have a lot of faces from my past experience. And if I were him, what I could say? Or if I were her, what kind of comment I gonna give to the teachers?
So they're still going around your own head?
Yes.
Have you a favorite book or blog or writer about education?
Yeah, well, I really admire my colleagues, Tad Watanabe, and then he's writing a blog a lot, and then you know he's a very nice, and then also.
Is he in DePaul University?
No, he's in the US, but he's the Japanese-American. And in mathematics education.
If you could make one change to your current school and resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
School usually do not have a common theme. I want the school as school teachers to be a team to address one important issue as a school so that the school become a team rather than each teacher compete each other.
And how could that happen?
Well, you need to share the common issue. So to do so, it's important to having entire teachers to have a discussion. What is most challenging in my school, in our school? And then, of course, there are a lot of challenges. However, you need to agree, we're gonna focus on this, and then let's work together to address this issue for next 3 years. So the long-term common goal so that the teacher can work together. That is more important, most important.
And what kind of a common goal could you envisage in a school that you know?
Well, for example, students are dependent learners often.
What's that, sorry?
Student may be a dependent learners, not independent learner.
Okay.
So, for example, if teacher present a problem to the student might say, "Oh, teacher, tell me how you do that." But we do not want the student become dependent. We want to be student become independent. Okay, I can do that. I want to try it. So that kind of issue is probably in many schools in Ireland.
Yeah, I think so. And what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
Well, as I said earlier, I was not happy student. I do not like the school mathematics. So that motivated me to become a math teacher.
So even a negative experience of learning can sometimes ultimately have a good result if it is used thoughtfully. That was Professor Akihiko Takahashi from DePaul University in the United States, and he is also a professor in Tokyo, Japan, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. If you'd like to listen back to this or almost 300 previous programs, you can go to seandelaney.com/podcasts. My book about teaching is called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, and you can borrow it from your local library or purchase it from any online bookstore. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Have a great week.